Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Paul Clark, a member of the club's International Relations Forum and your chair for today's program, entitled What is Terrorism and How Does It End with Captain Paul Shimella. Since 9/11, counterterrorism has been a growth industry. However, given the decline of Al-Qaeda, the lack of major attacks on U.S. soil, and the looming budgetary challenge our nation faces, it is fair to ask after a decade of the war on terror, counterterrorism operations, just what have we learned? And what is terrorism? And most importantly, how does it end? Our speaker, Captain Paul Shimella, is uniquely qualified to speak about these two last questions. Paul's retired from the Navy in 1996 after a career in special operations. He was a Navy SEAL. And during his military service, he planned and conducted counter-narcotics and counter-terrorism operations in Europe, Latin America, and elsewhere. He earned a master's degree at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey and was a senior fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Since 1998, Captain Shimella has been with the Center for Civil-Military Relations in Monterey, California, where he directs the Combating Terrorism Fellowship Program, focusing on civil-military relations and the response to terrorism of all kinds. In that capacity, he develops and teaches seminars and workshops in just about every region of the world, and he sent teams, many of which he's been on, he sent teams to 145 countries to do this work, our partners. He's assisted in this effort by a network of academicians, retired military members, governments, officials, and private sector individuals. And in the interest of full disclosure, I am one of the members of that circle, so you know where I'm coming from. And Paul is also the editor of the recent book, Fighting Back, What Can We Do About Terrorism, from Stanford University Press. And I could go on forever, but you don't want to hear me. You want to hear Captain Shimella. So, Paul, would you please come up and give us your lecture?
Thank you, Paul. And good evening to everyone. It's a great honor for me to come here and help you think about terrorism. I mentioned that I didn't know there'd be this many people in the room, and I'm glad because the more people we have, the more ideas we have in this room. I'll tell you some of my ideas, and I hope that you'll tell me and the rest of us some of yours. I have to say up front that these are my own views, not the views of the Center for Civil Military Relations, or the Naval Postgraduate School, or the U.S. government. I come here only to offer you food for thought and hopefully help you chew on it a little bit. None of these issues is simple. If you think it's simple, then you need to learn more about it. And the more you learn, the more you realize how complicated these issues are. There are very few right or wrong answers. So I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that this is the way it is. I mean, this is the way I think it is. But there's a lot of gray, and Americans, as you know, are not good at gray. I mean, we want it either black or white. That's not the way this works. So we all have things to learn from each other. Consequently, I'll leave plenty of time for questions and discussion. I normally begin by saying something funny, but there are no terrorism jokes. So I have to tell you a story. And this story is actually true. I could not make this up. The moral of the story is that we should be thankful for groups like this. As I will argue in a few minutes, informed citizens may be the most powerful weapon against terrorism in the long run. So when I was a student at the Naval Postgraduate School, I was a member of the World Affairs Council. And we were very excited to have Caspar Weinberger come to speak to us. And I was standing near the kitchen, waiting for him to come into the room, and I heard the following conversation take place between two of the cooks. "What's all the commotion about?" asked one. Said the other proudly, "Some guy named Weinberg is coming to speak. He's the Secretary of Offense." Well, I started laughing out loud because, of course, everyone knew that Caspar Weinberger was not the Secretary of Offense. It was 1980. Bill Walsh was the Secretary of Offense. The title of this talk implies that the definition of terrorism is not clear. And that is certainly the case at the international level. But I think that lack of clarity extends to the government level and the personal or individual level. I'm not a lawyer, but I've been thinking about terrorism for a long time. And I can perhaps help you sort out what it is and how it ends. But before we go further, I'd like to be clear on one point, and that is that terrorism is terrorism, no matter who does it or why they do it. Once you start making exceptions, then you're on a slippery slope to nowhere. So that's why it's even more important that we collectively reach a global consensus on what terrorism actually is. The lack of global consensus is easy enough to understand. Terrorism is a thorny problem, and the world is what scientists call a complex adaptive system, which means that it's unpredictable. We at the center in Monterey discuss terrorism with a lot of people from all over the world. They come to us with their own ideas on what terrorism is. And we tell them that a precise definition is not really the point, that you don't have to define a lion to know that it's dangerous or to do something about it, like run or fight it. But because they all live in different political circumstances, it's hardly surprising that almost 200 countries have a different idea or a different definition of what terrorism is exactly. I think one of the biggest stumbling blocks, as erroneous as it is this notion that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. So what is a freedom fighter? The best definition that I can come up with is that it's somebody who fights for a cause. Well, that would include me and probably everyone in this room. Everybody has a cause. But freedom fighters have choices, only one of which is terrorism. Just for the record, some of the other options include classic insurgency, guerrilla warfare, coup d'etat. I'm not recommending any of these. Riots, social media campaigns, and you saw that in action in Egypt recently. Mass demonstrations, you saw that in Egypt too, and other forms of nonviolent resistance. And, of course, the political process, the legitimate political process. The question is this: how do governments provide nonviolent channels for political dissent? Okay, how do we convince our citizens not to adopt the path of terrorism? How we can convince our freedom fighters not to be terrorists? But many unhappy people in the world have chosen violent ways of expressing their dissent, some of which I just listed. So when does violence become terrorism? Well, this lack of global consensus leaves individual governments to define terrorism as they wish. And, of course, all of them define it differently. And they define it, whether they realize it or not, in their laws. Their legislatures enact, most of them enact, anti-terrorism laws which define what terrorism is in a legal sense. And many of those laws make terrorism so broad that they dilute its true meaning. If you call everyone a terrorist, then nobody is a terrorist. Okay, so you have to draw the line somewhere. One government's terrorist may be another government's political dissident making noise in the street. So, you know, I've looked at a lot of definitions, a lot of laws on terrorism, and some of them are very short, but most of them are quite long, like a page long. It's very difficult to deal with a definition a page long. Just because you call someone a terrorist does not make him or her a terrorist. If we're going to start calling people terrorists, then we'd better exercise a great deal of care in deciding who actually are terrorists and who are not. As an example, there are very few people in this country who would refuse to call Timothy McVeigh a terrorist. But what about someone who publicly agrees with what he did? Is that person a terrorist too? What about a person who corresponded with him, who was friends with him? What about someone who knew someone, who went to a meeting where McVeigh was present? You see, you start asking these questions and it gets, you know, very complicated. But governments have to draw lines. And the U.S. government hasn't really helped. We have at least a dozen official definitions of terrorism. One for each major security institution. Now, the CIA has one, the FBI has one, the DOD has one. But actually, in 1988, the U.S. Army counted 109 definitions of terrorism worldwide. And I think it's more than that because most countries actually have laws which can be looked at like our law. And here's what our law says. U.S. Code, Title 22, Chapter 38, Paragraph 2656FD. Already we're in trouble. Quote, premeditated, politically motivated violence perpetrated against noncombatant targets by subnational groups or clandestine agents. Now what could be more clear than that? I would like to suggest a more practical way for ordinary citizens like us to understand what terrorism actually is. So when you think about a particular act of violence, there are five criteria that I think should come to mind. And if the act demonstrates evidence of all five, then I would suggest that whatever else it is, perhaps murder, it is indeed an act of terrorism. Whether the law defines it that way or not. So here's my list, and I wish I had a projector now, but these aren't that hard to remember. The first criterion is that the act be part of a consistent pattern of violence. Consistent pattern of violence. Second criterion, it's perpetrated for political or ideological reasons. And it's important to distinguish those two, and I'll explain that in a minute. The third criterion is that it's directed at innocent civilians. The fourth is that it is intended to produce a wide-ranging sense of fear. I think this one's probably the most important of the five. Terrorism produces fear. That's the only thing it produces. So think about how to counter or combat terrorism. If you take the fear out of it, then it's not terrorism, is it? It's hard to take fear out of it, but that's something that each individual citizen does have some control over. The last one, the last criterion, is that it's carried out on behalf of a group that shares the motives of the perpetrator. There is a group identity piece to this characterization. Okay, so consistent pattern of violence perpetrated for political or ideological reasons, directed against innocent civilians, produces a wide-ranging sense of fear, carried out on behalf or in sympathy with a group. Okay, if a bomb goes off in this room, kills all of us, we're not the real victims, are we? I mean, we're dead, but the real victims are out in the city. The people who are looking over their shoulders when they get on a bus. Okay, that's what terrorism is. Wide-ranging sense of fear. I call this a litmus test for terrorism. And if we want to understand something, it's often useful to distinguish it from something else that shares similar characteristics. This litmus test helps me distinguish terrorism from insurgency and organized crime. It even helps me understand a little bit more about the drug war in Mexico. Okay, it's not just organized crime, but it's probably not terrorism. So this is kind of a working definition that we can apply as a test. The litmus test also serves to warn governments that if they use violence too often or too indiscriminately, they will be vulnerable to being labeled as a terrorist state. And there are lots and lots of states that are vulnerable because they use a lot of terror. Okay, and the United States, of course, is on that list. And words do mean things. It doesn't help when journalists or politicians refer to acts of terrorism by calling the killers insurgents or militants or rebels. When I was in Pakistan, they called them miscreants. Yeah, well, right after I left, some of those miscreants blew up both hotels that I stayed in, one in Islamabad and one in Peshawar. So I didn't think they were really miscreants. But again, sloppy labeling makes the challenge of dealing with terrorism even more difficult. Governments often label terrorist groups as terrorist. The State Department has a list of 52 groups around the world that we have officially labeled as terrorist groups. Okay. When governments do that, they need to be careful. Because when you label a group as terrorist, it narrows the options that you have in dealing with that group. And some groups do other things besides terrorism, and that makes it even more difficult. Hamas, Hezbollah, we have designated them as terrorist groups, but they provide humanitarian assistance. In some cases, they govern. How do you deal with that? It's hard, very hard. I mentioned Timothy McVeigh. If you apply the litmus test to his act of violence in Oklahoma City, you get what looks like a mixed result. This attack, the Oklahoma City bombing, was not part of a pattern. It was his first attack. It was not intended to create a wide-ranging sense of fear, and it was not conducted, at least on the surface, on behalf of an organized group. Timothy McVeigh killed 168 innocent people because he was upset about what the government had done at Ruby Ridge, Waco, and a few other places. However, had he not been arrested right away, he might have continued his violent attacks in the same way that Eric Robert Rudolph did before he went to hide in the woods of North Carolina. McVeigh's act might have created a sense of fear over time of working in government buildings or all buildings. So we can suspect or speculate that fear was something that he could have been creating in this wide area, and he was acting in sympathy certainly with a wide range of anti-government groups, all exchanging hate speech on the internet. So when you look at it that way, The McVeigh case is actually a pretty good application of the five criteria. Incidentally, McVeigh was convicted by a federal court, and I think all of you probably know this, but it's worth pointing out again that he was executed for 168 counts of murder, not terrorism. And it's also noteworthy that, and this is not a political statement, that there was no visible reaction from death penalty opponents in this case. And that's exactly the point. We tend to think of terrorists as worse than murderers. And we do that, I think, because it affects us personally. Okay, and that's the fear. Every act of terrorism makes us think, boy, that could have been me. Okay, so that makes it different than murder. To use another example, ask yourself if the bombing of the USS Cole was an act of terrorism or not. Okay, or was it targeting of naval personnel in uniform aboard ship an act of war? Was it just murder? What was it? Okay. What about Afghanistan and Iraq? Where should a government draw the line? The government needs to characterize these acts as something, because that something will determine how a government retaliates, if at all. So governments are in the business of drawing lines. They decide what is permitted and what is not permitted, what is terrorism and what is not terrorism. For instance, where's the line between hopeful diplomacy and military intervention? You know, I mean, we get up every morning and read about the agonizing decisions that our own government has to make in that regard. Well, terror, I think it's important to distinguish between the word terror and terrorism. The word terror, I think, defines a tactic. Terror is a tactic used basically by four distinct groups of human beings. Terrorists, certainly, who use it a lot. Insurgents, who use it sometimes. Criminals, who use it against each other mostly. And states, who use it against threats, particularly if they think those threats are existential. Terrorism is the next step. Terrorism, I think, is a strategy. And that goes back to this consistent pattern of violence. As a country, we can choose to have war against an organization, say Al-Qaeda, but it makes no sense, in my opinion, to have a war against terror or even terrorism. It just doesn't make any sense. So we are at war with Al-Qaeda. Anyway, let me leave the rest of this discussion for the question and answer period and move on to the issue of how terrorism ends. Audrey Kurth Cronin has written that terrorist groups have six possible pathways to the end of terrorism as a strategy, all of which are outcomes of a contest between governments and terrorists. The first pathway she calls decapitation. The second pathway is negotiation. The third is success. Fourth is failure. Fifth is repression. Sixth is reorientation. Let me give you some brief examples of each one. The pathway of decapitation removes group leaders, either by killing them or, often better, capturing them. The best-known example of this is the killing of Osama bin Laden, of course, but the arrest of leaders such as Shoko Asahara of Amshin Rikyo, that cult responsible for gassing the Tokyo subway in 1995, or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or any number of others, are worth talking about. We can discuss the pros and cons of killing versus capturing if you wish. But both are accepted practices of governments who have defined terrorism as the threat. And again, the governments have defined it for themselves because the UN can't seem to define it. The second pathway, negotiation, is another acceptable alternative for governments. Although virtually all governments say they will not or ever negotiate with terrorists, most of them do. They find ways to do it, either directly or indirectly. Why do they do it? Because terrorism cannot be defeated by just taking out the leaders. There are a mix of approaches that I think are required in order to really put an end to terrorism. The Good Friday Accord, negotiated in secret between the IRA and the British government, is an example of the pathway of negotiation. But it also reminds us, the IRA case, that governments can pursue more than one path at the same time. The pathway of success, the third pathway, is actually quite rare among terrorist groups. There aren't a lot of examples out there, about 5% statistically, that would exhibit something we would recognize as success. Perhaps the best example is the African National Congress, South Africa. In most of the cases where terrorist groups have succeeded, they've succeeded by transforming themselves into more or less a legitimate insurgency. In other words, they stop targeting civilians. And when a terrorist group stops targeting civilians and only targets the government or the military, it starts to look more like an insurgency than a terrorist campaign. But success is a relative term. You know, most terrorists groups don't really want to govern. Some do, but most don't. Most older groups are characterized by the slogan, "We bomb, therefore we are." And after a while, there's nothing left except the act of violence. This would characterize the Basque terrorists, the ETA of Spain, for instance, where the Spanish government is giving them and has given them just everything they've asked for except independence, which they'll never get. But they won't take yes for an answer, and they go right back to bombing eventually. For this type of group, mere existence equals success. The pathway of failure, it turns out, is indeed also an option for terrorist groups. Many groups implode, they burn out, or they're forced by governments to go underground, sometimes for decades. Some clever governments can infiltrate them, destroy their cohesion, and break them up from the inside. Terrorist groups with religiously inspired ideology tend to splinter on their own because of internal disputes. Most terrorist groups fail to attract enough popular support to change the way states are governed. And legitimate governments can find ways to nudge them towards failure, and that's really what strategy is. The pathway of repression here refers to overwhelming military force in an overseas situation or heavy police coercion at home. Well, repression sometimes seems to work, as it did in Peru with the Shining Path, but in the long run, it probably won't work. It normally creates a backlash, and it doesn't solve the problem. The Shining Path, for instance, is now back in Peru, having been repressed, having been militarily defeated, but it's back. And why is it back? Because the Peruvian government has not solved the problems that created it in the first place. Okay. So root causes are incredibly important here. Repression by foreign occupation doesn't work either. And you've seen that in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. I think one rule of thumb is that local solutions to countering insurgency and terrorism are better. The final pathway is reorientation. And this is a strategy by which governments nudge or bludgeon terrorist groups into transforming themselves. And we saw this, I think, most clearly in El Salvador. And actually, El Salvador's former terrorists, former insurgents, whatever you wanted to call them, are now in government. They're part of the mainstream political process. They got tired, and they just decided to take another pathway, and this is how it turned out. Now, that's not to say that El Salvador is well-governed now or is a particularly safe place to be, because it's not, but they don't have the problem of terrorism. They have a problem of organized crime. Anyway, none of these pathways are independent of one another, and there are no fixed categories here. So wise governments track the evolution of terrorist groups over time, adjusting their strategies to maximize the probability that terrorism will end, and it will end on the government's terms. Okay. I described the six pathways as possible outcomes of a contest between governments and terrorists, because they are competing, but they're competing for legitimacy. That's really what it's about. Think of legitimacy, this contest is a tug of war, with legitimacy as the rope. One contestant can pull all the legitimacy to its side, but only one, in the end, can have it. Insurgency is an interesting term, because insurgents and terrorists are very similar. Many terrorists start out as insurgents, full of ideological fervor and dreams of societal change. Well, pretty quickly, that starts going away. And they start attacking civilians, because they're weaker than government forces in most cases. So insurgency has a shelf life. If it doesn't succeed quickly, it turns into something else. And sometimes that something else is nastier than insurgency in the first place. But terrorists don't just give up very often. If insurgents take a shortcut by becoming terrorist organizations, because it's easier to attack civilians, then they normally unleash a counter-terrorist campaign that lasts even longer. So by trying to take a shortcut, they actually are in, sometimes for decades-long, struggle with the government. If this sounds like a paradox, it is. It's not the only paradox in this business. So how does the government shape the outcome it wants? I think you do this by increasing the expected costs of terrorist organizations and decreasing their expected benefits. And you do this through various tools: diplomacy, information, military force, economic policy, financial seizure, intelligence, law enforcement, emergency management, society itself, citizens deciding not to be afraid, helping the government to create a climate of security. And then, of course, moral factors. You know, how do governments harness moral power? It seems to me that's an advantage governments have. Terrorists don't have it. They'll never have it. So we have to figure out how to harness moral power. This is what we sometimes call a whole-of-nation approach. Governments express these means through developing institutions. Institutions are more important than individuals. Institutions are where things happen. Okay. So we have a lot to talk about. Let me just sum up by stating or restating what we called in the book the 10 strategic precepts of combating terrorism. And we can talk about these in detail if you want. The first precept is develop a comprehensive set of strategies. Okay, that's fairly intuitive. Number two, keep the use of force limited and appropriate, but be prepared to use force. Number three, build consensus all around. Number four, strengthen social cohesion. Number five, hold the moral high ground. Number six, build institutional capacity. Number seven, improve border security. Number eight is educate everyone. Number 9, control the narrative. Number 10, and perhaps the most important, govern well. We can make terrorist groups go away, although, in my opinion, we'll never eliminate that part of human nature that fuels political violence. But if governments use all their tools according to the 10 precepts and governments work together, it's my belief that we can collectively transform terrorism from the global security problem it is today back into the national level criminal problem that it was a long time ago, it seems. You know, many of you, I remember the 1960s. We had a lot of problems, but terrorism was not the most important problem we had. So I'd like to leave it there and take your questions. Please.
Thank you, Captain Shimola. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to the program, What is Terrorism and How Does It End, with retired Navy Captain Paul Shimola. And Jim will pass the microphone. Please use the microphone so we could capture your question.
Captain, in view of the use of drones by the Obama administration, I understand they've thought quite carefully about the application. How would you criticize, how would you view that decision?
Drones are a very interesting new development. We didn't have this technology prior to 9/11. We didn't even have it after 9/11. It's just in the last really 4 or 5 years that it's come into its own. Drones, like most weapons, are a two-edged sword. The Obama administration, as you point out, has used drone strikes quite often. 300 plus drone strikes, 2,500 killed estimated, and of course some of those are civilians. Way too many are civilians, in my opinion. As surgical as it is, there is collateral damage, and there will be as long as we use it. But we are at war with Al-Qaeda, and there is a legal argument that would favor that would allow the use of drones. That's the argument that the administration makes, and I'm not a lawyer, but the argument against drone is just as cogent, and it revolves around collateral damage. The laws of war, the laws of armed conflict, are based on two fundamental pillars: discrimination and proportionality. Drones, even as precise as they are, if they're used repeatedly, they violate discrimination at some point. And you know, we're there. On the other hand, we're not at war with the Lord's Resistance Army. You're not going to see drone strikes in Central Africa anytime soon. Where you see drone strikes is where there are terrorists plotting to kill Americans. And there's basically three countries: Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And it becomes very complicated. Every country where drones are used by American forces is different. In Yemen, the president of Yemen calls it a miraculous weapon. I mean, he loves it. And of course, he has a say in every one of the attacks. The administration has written just recently more stringent and clear rules on how targeted killings are to be performed. And I hate to even use that term, but that's what it is. And like it or not, that is one of the tools that this government and many others will be using. One of the problems with drones is it proliferates. That technology is now available to everybody. And you're starting to see drones in some places where you didn't want to see them, and it's just going to get worse. So stand by for heavy rolls, as we used to say in the Navy. That's about as far as I could go right now with the time we have. But, technology works both ways. Yes.
All right. Thank you for your comments tonight and your candidness on the topic. Now, to explore both ends of your thesis on this, one, is there a point at which government intervention or armed conflict that has a significant proportion, majority, whatever, of civilian casualties becomes terror against that civilian population, regardless of its additional aims? And on the other end, for very low investment actors, we hear nowadays about cyber terrorism, and I'm wondering whether you find that term misused, despite the fact that some of the more advanced attack code that can target infrastructure that can cause physical harm is moving into that sphere.
Yeah. Let me take the second question first. We teach cyber terrorism as one of a host of cyber threats. The cyber attacks can go from espionage through terrorism all the way to being a very important part of armed conflict, as we saw in Georgia with the Russians. I think cyber attacks are important to take seriously when you're talking about terrorism, primarily because critical infrastructure has become so dependent on cyber systems. You know, these SCADA systems that control our power plants and our water supply and lots of other pieces of critical infrastructure are vulnerable to cyber attack. Cyber attack can have physical consequences. Conversely, physical attacks can also have cyber consequences. You know, if terrorists find out where all the cables are buried, where all the cables cross, and they blow that up, then a lot of your cyber systems just go completely down. So I think cyber terrorism should be seen as one of a spectrum of threats, and that's the way we teach it. But like drones, cyber technology in the short run works for countries like the United States. In the long run, it works against us maybe at least as much. So that's something the U.S. government's taking very seriously, and you're going to read and hear a lot more about it. But you can see how powerful it is. And even someone like me, who has a limited understanding of these systems, can go to bed at night thinking about it. On warfare, when any time, and we've seen this since the beginning of warfare, which was a very long time ago, when nations commit armed forces to armed conflict, there are civilian casualties. The civilians always get it, often much worse than military forces. We have various terms to describe this. Collateral damage doesn't do the job for me. We have terms like war crimes. I think terrorism kind of loses itself in a conventional conflict. The way I like to think of this is when there are too many civilian casualties, when civilians are targeted deliberately by armed forces, that's a war crime. And we actually have an international legal regime to deal with that. And the U.S. needs to be part of that, in my opinion. We've seen it just get off the ground. Charles Taylor was convicted. You're going to see a lot more of that, and I think you'll see the U.S. sign on to it eventually. But again, discrimination and proportionality. If those two principles are violated, then you're either talking about terrorism outside of an armed conflict or war crimes within an armed conflict. That's the way I think about it. But the United Nations is having trouble coming up with this convention, this so-called Comprehensive Convention Against International Terrorism, CSIT. They've been working on this for decades. And there are three areas that are preventing them from getting a convention that can be put on the floor and approved by a significant number of countries. The three areas that are so vexing for this committee, it's called the Sixth Committee. One is the legal definition of terrorism. We've talked about that. The second is the relationship between terrorism and anti-colonial and national liberation movements. That's the second issue. The third issue is gets to your question, the activities of states' armed forces in armed conflicts and in the exercise of their official duties. So we do have laws for war, and in those laws, there are penalties for those who violate them. I could read you the draft definition of terrorism that the UN is working on, but it would take me the rest of the time. Please.
Captain, the U.S. terrorism czar, do you think he's being effective in addressing terrorism along the lines of your thesis? And if there's gaps in that, what recommendations would you have to offer him to perform that better?
Well, let me first say I'm glad I'm not him. I called it a thorny problem. I mean, that's putting it mildly. I guess you're referring to Mr. Brennan. I don't know Mr. Brennan, but from what I read and what I hear, he seems to be doing a pretty good job of balancing what we call hard power and soft power. And governments have to do that. Hard power being armed forces, law enforcement, and certain other types of coercive power. Soft power being those government tools that allow us to persuade people that our ideas are worthwhile and to attract them to our culture and into a relationship with the U.S. that biases them towards peaceful criticism. It's very difficult to balance this hard power, soft power. Hillary Clinton calls it smart power, which I think is a good term. So I can assure you that the whole U.S. government, as it's now reorganized for fighting terrorism, is trying to do exactly that. What you read about and hear about most often is the kinetic or coercive side. But there's an awful lot going on that you don't read a lot about. I'll take the example of Yemen. In Yemen, we have, just in this year, 2012, assistance to Yemen has been $337 million. Okay, over half of that has been used for political transition, humanitarian assistance, and development. You pick up the paper and you read about a drone strike in Yemen, but you don't read about the humanitarian assistance. You don't read about people like me who have gone in there and talked to the Yemeni officials about this balanced approach to fighting terrorism. I mean, I was there in June, and it was remarkable. We had 70 people in the room from three different ministries, the defense, interior, and foreign affairs. There were even six women in there, and every one of those women stood up and said what she thought. Even the ones that were covered to their fingertips had opinions that were valued by the rest of the group. I was really stunned to see that. So the picture is much better than what you read. And I think it would be very difficult for me to criticize the Obama administration in sort of the macro view. I mean, there are certain mistakes that they've made, and they'd be the first ones to admit it. But I think on balance, they're doing pretty well. Yes.
Yes, I'd like to continue with this train of thought about the soft power, and specifically the Supreme Court decision Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project, which you're familiar with.
Not as much as you are.
Well, all right. For the audience, very briefly, there are nonprofit groups in the United States and elsewhere who have tried. To find peaceful resolution working with terrorist groups. Mm-hmm. And one was the Humanitarian Law Project. The other one is the Carter Institute. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they were working with groups like the PKK, the Tamil Tigers. I believe the Carter group also worked with Hamas. Mm-hmm. And they were, without going into a great deal of detail here, they were told that their work was in violation of the material support clause. I guess that's of the Patriot Act, I'm not sure, which means that it's against the law to help and assist any terrorist group, no matter what the help is. Mm-hmm. Even talking with them, helping them to find peaceful resolutions for terrorist concerns is against the law. It's punishable by imprisonment and fines.
Yeah.
So these groups who were trying, and I think with some success, to help terrorist groups find nonviolent means to address their concerns have been told, you can't do that. So I'd like you to comment on that.
Okay. I'm glad you asked that because it illustrates the comment that I made earlier in that governments should be careful about designating foreign terrorist groups. I mean, if you designate a group as a terrorist group, then you walk right into conflicts like that. If those groups were not formally designated as terrorist, then those laws would not kick in. So these people are trying to do the right thing, but because they're working with formally designated terrorist groups, the government feels as though they have to be prohibited or prosecuted. That doesn't sit well with me either. There's something wrong. When somebody's trying to do the right thing, they shouldn't be punished. But if you understand the legal framework, you can see that there have to be laws, and if we don't like those laws, then we should change them. And in fact, anti-terrorism laws are very different than other laws. You know, the Constitution, the function of a Constitution is what? It's to protect the people against the government. Okay? I mean, protect the people from their own government. That's what a constitution is. And laws that are written within the framework of a constitution support that. Well, anti-terrorism laws actually make the government stronger relative to the people. So they actually are, they're not anti-constitutional, but they tend, as they pile up, to violate the principles of a constitution. You know, all governments are trying to balance liberty and security. And what happens right after you get bombed? Say, take away all of my rights. I don't care. Just don't let this happen again, right? Well, 6 months later, when you haven't been bombed again, you're saying, well, what about those rights? You took away those rights. I want them back. The government says, well, if you get them back, then, you know, the probability that you're going to get bombed is going to increase. So governments are always doing this. When you write an anti-terrorism law, it has to have a sunset clause. It has to be reviewed 6 months later or a year later to make sure that it's still needed, okay, that it still makes sense. And a lot of times governments don't do that. They write an anti-terrorism law and they leave it on the books for 30 years. Okay. So, I mean, that's my comment. I don't know anything else except to, you know, to use what power you have as a citizen to try to get the laws changed. Write articles. I mean, based on your question, I'm going to start talking about that in my classes. So we'll see. Thank you. Yes.
Do you foresee the U.S. government taking concrete steps to try and force the Pakistani state to stop its support for terrorist groups?
As of today, the U.S. government has not labeled the government of Pakistan as a supporter of terrorism. There are many in the government here, as you know, who think that Pakistan, especially the ISI, is in league with some of the terrorist organizations. Some of the organizations that we've labeled as terrorist, most recently the Haqqanis. So even though we think that they should not be aligned with those groups, we haven't made a formal designation. And that gets back to your question, ma'am. The fact that we haven't made a formal designation means that we have more flexibility in dealing with the government of Pakistan. And so I think that you'll see more of the same where we continue to be tolerant of some of the things that we don't like about what Pakistan is doing in order to have normal relations with Pakistan on some other issues. Okay, I mean, Pakistan is a very important country to us, and to label it a supporter of terrorism, it seems to me, would be to put it in the same category as North Korea and Iran, and we don't want to do that. We think that although the relationship is complicated, that we're better off trying to sort of attract the Pakistani government to our point of view, at the same time moderating our positions enough so that we develop some kind of mutual trust that we've lost. It's just very that's probably the most difficult foreign policy challenge we have.
Paul, you have two questions, it looks like. Okay. Those will be your last two questions.
There's a wonderful Pakistani restaurant in Berkeley.
Oh, good.
On San Pablo, just north of university. But I want to make a quick comparison of U.S. foreign policy in Asia and the Middle East, because I was born in the U.S., but my father told me when I started first grade, say you're nationalist, not communist Chinese. And he was a supporter of Mao in those days. So my baby boomer generation grew up in the car culture, the heydays of the 50s and 60s. And then we hit the Vietnam War, which many decades later, people talk about what were the interests of Michelin in French Indochina. So my mother could not send money to her family in China because of the Trading with Enemies Act. So looking at what was communism, I kind of think terrorism is now the new communism, which is what are the histories and geopolitics? I'm glad you mentioned neocolonialism, which hasn't left us. So I got to go to the Middle East twice, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv in 71, and this young Palestinian boy said he hoped for peace when he grew up. So I'm going to make this connection to grandmother power now with my grandchildren, right? I kind of like that slogan that you see in the anti-war marches. And there's a mural on Church Street near Market, and you can find this little slogan. What is our oil doing under their sand? So you take geopolitical interests at different stages of history. And so, I'm American, my grandkids have dual citizenship, okay, American and South African.
But maybe we can let Paul address that.
So in terms of, resource acquisition, can we have a world where Americans learn to share the resources and the power? And I think most grandmothers agree with me.
Well, I for one, certainly hope so. Some of you may have the impression that people that have served in the military or are currently in the military have this different view of the world, that they view the world in terms of violence and coercion. I would not agree with that. I think that people in the military are they're a sample of society at large, and they have generally a pretty balanced view of how the world works and how it could work better. So I think that resource distribution has always been a problem. It will always be a problem. It doesn't have to drive terrorism. It doesn't have to drive state-on-state conflict. That's why we have institutions like the United Nations and all of its members. We have civil societies who spawn non-governmental organizations, who bridge the gap between governments. I'm actually pretty optimistic about the global picture. I think that there are lots and lots of ways that governments are cooperating, and terrorism is one of them. I mean, there are very few governments who are not cooperating in the global struggle against terrorism. It's a difficult thing to organize, just like the struggle against climate change is a difficult thing to organize. Resources are a thorny issue because, that's what drives economies. What I would like to see, for starters, is the U.S. Senate ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty that was signed in 1982. That, I think, would go a long way to showing that the American government can actually share resources globally in a way that benefits everybody. Yes?
Just 1 minute, please. Thank you.
Captain Schimmel, I'd appreciate your comments as a captain who's done a lot in the SEALs situation on the propriety and the legality of a retired now SEAL writing the book, nationwide television, seven others that have talked. It used to be we thought, and I know many SEALs, they don't talk about anything that they've done, and so I was really surprised to see what happened.
Yeah. Well, you won't get me talking about anything I've done. I think what's going on now is perhaps it was predictable, maybe even inevitable. But the SEALs that are speaking out and writing books are violating the ethos that drives the SEAL community, the special operations community, and the military community at large. The ethos is, and we actually say this in the beginning, I'm a quiet professional. What I do stays with me. And I've always adhered to that, and 99% of my colleagues, my teammates, have adhered to it. But it only takes one. I know that the leadership within the community, the active community, is taking measures to make sure this doesn't happen anymore. In my opinion, they should have taken those measures earlier, but I don't think you're going to see too much more of this. It is an embarrassment to me, to be honest.
Our thanks to our speaker and his very informative ideas and your great questions. I also want to thank the sponsoring organizations, the Truman National Security Institute and the UN Association of Marin. Our volunteers, Jim Davis and Wendy Hall, and our chair, Norma Walden. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.